Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Focus, our opportunity each week to have an extended conversation with many of those who are public leaders in the new evangelization. We do this program because the Catholic imagination, the Catholic moral perspective, the Catholic idea of the human being and the human community are all vitally needed in the modern world. The world as it is today is in many ways a kind of dangerous mess, I guess, and it needs to be restored to the beauty that God intends of it. Dappled Things, a quarterly journal of ideas, art, faith, is itself a thing of beauty. Each quarter it arrives as a thing of beauty with poems, stories, drawings, paintings, and so on. But it's also kind of a defense. Just its very existence is a defense of the very idea of beauty as a relevant category. Our guest today is Bernardo Aparicio Garcia, founder and publisher of Dappled Things. He grew up in Cali, Colombia, then moved to the United States to attend the University of Pennsylvania, where he studied economics and international relations. But he also received an MA in liberal arts from the Great Books Program at St. John's College in Annapolis. Bernardo Garcia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So maybe I could just start with, what is Dappled Things? For those who don't know, what is it? How do you describe it?
Sure. We are a quarterly journal. We publish short stories, we publish poetry, we publish nonfiction also on a variety of different topics, and we publish visual art as well. So we really, there are a lot of journals out there, very quality Catholic journals that cover a lot of different topics, but we're really the only journal with a national presence that that focuses on creative work. From Catholic writers or writers inspired by the Catholic vision of the world, and we don't want to just talk about the culture, but really help build the culture, create new cultural works that can inspire people, that can help us delve deeper into understanding the world around us. So,
now I wonder how much of your experience with the literary world maybe limits the opportunities of someone who wants to, say, write or produce a visual art from a Catholic perspective. Is there any of that in Dappled Things, the idea that, well, we need a place because many of the traditional places for publishing aren't open to this? Or is it because you want to have a place where that is the kind of aesthetic that permeates everything?
Right. Well, I guess I'd go two ways about it. On the one hand, I would say yes. You're right that to some extent, questions of faith, of God, the meaning of life, and so on, often get shoved to the side in secular journals. However, on the other hand, I do want to say that sometimes it's easy for writers or people who want to become writers of fiction or poetry or artists to say, well, I'm Catholic, and if they didn't accept my work at X journal or X exhibition, it's because they have a bias against Catholics. And they very well may or may not have a bias. I'm not going to make a pronouncement on that, but often it is because we ourselves haven't been demanding enough of ourselves as writers or artists. And so one thing we really do want to focus on is, just being Catholic isn't enough for us to publish you. We want to have the highest standards of quality, so that being published in Dappled Things basically can set you up for being published anywhere. So that's something definitely that we do want to promote. And I would say it's this way, maybe. Perhaps to get the same level of attention as a Catholic writer, as a non-Catholic writer might get, you'd have to be perhaps even better than they are.
Yeah.
But if you get good enough, I think you eventually do get attention, and there are many current writers that that are starting to do just that. But sometimes it takes, you know, it takes twice the effort, perhaps. But I do believe. I mean, one reason we want to have the journal is to inspire Catholics to take up this work, to use their talents for building up the culture, for creating new works of beauty, and to make them be demanding of themselves, so that the work we're going to produce will be good enough to really make an impact beyond just the Catholic community.
And so there are two worlds for you as a journal as well, as a review, really. And one of those worlds is the art world, with its various publications and cultures and subcultures. And then the other is the Catholic world. I'm not trying to say that these are completely distinct worlds, but so how have you been received in both of those worlds? How have you been received in the literary world, for example, and then on the other hand, in the Catholic world?
Right. I'd say we have a stronger presence in what you might call the Catholic world, as far as being well known and so on. I think there's a fair number of people in the Catholic world that know about Dapple Things already. In the literary world, I'd say, you know, we're still a fairly small magazine among many, many small literary magazines that there are out there.
Mm-hmm.
I usually haven't experienced, any sort of hostility or anything like that. It is definitely a different kind of journal. So, for example, one time when we attended the Association of Writing Programs conference, people were, who would come to our table would sometimes be like, "Oh, well, what are you about?" And ask questions about it, and they found it interesting. They recognized our name often from the famous poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins that
right.
has the word Dappled Things in its first line. And so a lot of Hopkins fans would come and talk to us about it. There is, I would say, at least somewhat of an openness to it, but definitely we're a little different from what you might get from a lot of other magazines.
Yeah.
In just the secular art world. It makes us a little bit of an odd duck, but I think we've also been, well received, and we get a lot of submissions from writers who've been published in the largest magazines, and people
right.
who have been published in the New Yorker, people who have been published in all sorts of different big publications. So it does seem like we've been able to attract a fair amount of attention. Just to give you an idea, actually, our the first year we did a fiction prize, we started, paying for a contest for short fiction. We got 400 submissions, and it was definitely from beyond writers who were, you might consider, simply within the Catholic world, but
yep.
writers who found the theme interesting and decided to submit their work. There's somewhat of an openness, but then we're also a little bit of an upduck.
And I wonder if in the literary world today, and it's like you mentioned the New Yorker, it seems that there's certain things that are considered, I don't know, cutting edge, or this is where we are right now. Certain things that are, I guess the word they might use is transgressive. Certain things that are very much about identity, So maybe a story by someone who professes a very or about someone maybe who professes a really unique identity, almost exotic. It seems to me there's a kind of almost exoticism about the whole thing. That does not comport really, I suppose, with the Catholic view of beauty. Just to be transgressive, to be cutting edge, to be just maybe odd for the sake of being odd. I wonder if you, what your view of that would be. Is your very conception of what is beautiful different than a place like, say, the New Yorker?
Right. I mean, the thing is that quote-unquote transgressive art, you know, how much can you transgress before you eventually just become boring, right? I mean, it's almost like the new convention, right? So to look at it one way, right, the transgressive abstract art of one era becomes the hotel lobby art of the next era. So if you're going to, you know, if that's going to be what you think is going to make great work, you eventually run into that problem. So we really focus more on timeless values in art. We want to, you know, we want to look, first of all, you know, at of course, the quality of craftsmanship, but then go beyond that, and we want to, you know, we want to ask the big questions in our writing about, you know, about what it means to be human, about, you know, about God, about morality, about, you know, questions that are timeless, that where stories or pieces of visual art or poems that we publish are really going to speak universally to people, rather than you know, rather than focusing on, well, is this work more shocking than the last work we published?
Yeah,
because that leads nowhere. That's a blind alley.
Yeah. Okay. So I really like that the transgressive art of one generation becomes the hotel lobby art, because I've been in some hotel lobbies where I thought the art was transgressive, but maybe not in the way they intended. But okay. So the Catholic view of beauty then is, well, you know, your take on that, like, you, if a journal is going to present itself as both a journal that is truly devoted to the art, to the artistic level, meaning real beauty is expressed there, and it's at the same time going to present itself as being a Catholic journal, what is, in your view, the Catholic understanding of beauty? What is beauty? What's it all about?
Right. I mean, one thing that I would say is that you do, when you talk about beauty, like when you talk about several of the other transcendentals, but especially when you're looking at beauty, for which there is definitely a subjective component to it, although I wouldn't say, I would definitely not sign up to the idea that beauty is just in the eye of the beholder, but there is a subjective component to it. It's a personal response to something real that is out there. That's the way I would put it. So you have to, I think you have to approach it humbly. So I wouldn't say necessarily that, you know, that the work, you know, that the work that we publish is guaranteed to have beauty, right?
Yeah.
But we pursue it, right? That's what we pursue. And, you know, and an artist in pursuing it doesn't have the benefit of, for example, you know, a Catholic who's seeking the truth about God and has the magisterium to rely on, right? We, you know, when we're talking about art, there's no magisterium that tells you this is, you know, this is beautiful and this is not beautiful, and, you know, you can just rely on that.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a question of a pursuit, right? But it is something worth pursuing, because ultimately, you know, the ultimate source of beauty is God Himself. So it's something real that is out there, and that I think we all react to. I think when we, you know, people will, it's a popular opinion that, oh, you know, beauty's subjective, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and whatever, but when you truly encounter beauty, it is not something that you feel comes from within you, that, you know, that, oh, well, I made it up, but,
yeah,
you know, nobody else, you know, somebody else would feel totally different. Well, maybe they will or maybe they won't, but the point is that when you encounter something beautiful, it grabs you from without and it pulls you, you know, out of yourself. So that's what we try to find. And ideally, we think, you know, true beauty is ultimately at a deep level in accordance with, you know, with goodness and truth. And it is an aspect of, it is an aspect of reality in a sense. So it's something definitely worth exploring and worth taking seriously. Unfortunately, a lot of not just the modern art world, but the modern world in general has taken beauty as something that, we can't all quite agree that the same painting is beautiful, and therefore we can just give up on it, and it's meaningless, and why even bother with it? Let's just make whatever is expedient or whatever sells the most, bottles of shampoo or whatever it is, and forget about this concept. But when we do that, unfortunately, a part of our soul kind of dies, and you see that not just in art. I think what we normally call art, but I think one easy place to see that is if you go to cities on the communist bloc, and you look at the architecture there,
right,
and how it communicates this emptiness almost. It's like it's represented in the architecture itself, because ideas such as beauty ended up being considered either useless, or that they communicated some sort of anti-communist hierarchical values or something like that, and therefore they needed to be removed. And of course, what resulted was something that was really soul-killing. And one striking place where you can see that is if you go to TV Tower up in Berlin, and you see the communist half of the city and the half that was free, and it's a very stark contrast. You can see it just by looking at the rooftops. In our own country, it takes a different tack. But we focus more, if we're looking at architecture, we focus more on expediency, but also luxury and flashiness.
Yeah.
And we value cool above, something, truly beautiful. So there's that in both sides. And I think it affects how we see ourselves, how we see the world. So it's something that ultimately, I would say, is spiritually corrosive. So I think that cultivating beauty in our lives is something that is really important and ultimately very spiritually nourishing.
And if we're surrounded by ugliness, as your the East Berlin example is one really stark. I mean, really truly, you see some of those communist era cities, and it's horrifying. The image of the human being that people must have held in their hearts to create such brutal landscapes is horrifying. But today you go to Las Vegas, for example, and there it's a completely different view of the human being, but in its own way also horrifying. I'm not trying to be mean to Las Vegas, but it has a certain – but that's all of – I mean, anywhere you go now, there is this – like you said, that grandiosity, that kind of luxury, opulence, the passing for beauty. So, but
right.
So both this hyper individualist and then also the communist view give us a kind of ugliness. Do you think that beauty itself, though, whether it's architectural beauty or a painting or a poem or whatnot, has a revitalizing effect? Like, can we like replug people back into their humanity via beauty?
No, absolutely. I am a firm believer in that. I mean, I think you need more than just beauty, but I think it's an important component. And that's another, and that's another reason that the magazine exists, is because, even within the church, we've given up a lot of our patrimony of beauty. And when we do, we just become let's say easy prey for a lot of mistakes that we can make, intellectually, morally, and just in life. Because something has to substitute for it, right? If you haven't cultivated an understanding of true beauty and appreciation for true beauty, because sometimes beauty can be a little hard, right? It's easier to watch a sitcom than to sit down and read War and Peace. But you know, the nourishing effect that, and I have nothing against sitcoms, right? But when they're the only thing that we can appreciate, then that's when it becomes a problem. Because if we don't have, you know, I do believe that to a certain extent we can become desensitized to beauty. And because other things are easier, and maybe they give us a quicker, you know, a quicker fix, a quicker high. And when that happens, you know, sometimes our priorities become disordered. Sometimes it's harder to live the spiritual life, because, I mean, ultimately, a holy life is a beautiful life. And if we can't even recognize what beauty is, then maybe holiness becomes not something beautiful, but something that's purely a matter of, let's say, maybe following the rules, right?
Yes.
But,
yeah.
But everybody knows that, you know, that that's not, you know, yes, you know, obedience is an important part of holiness, but it's not the totality of it. And, you know, and the saints lived beautiful lives. So it's something that I think we all need to nourish. And like I was saying, you know, within the Catholic community, sometimes we've confused, I see a few things. One is that sometimes we confuse something simply being pious or something simply being, let's say, in agreement with our beliefs, with it being beautiful.
Yes.
And we sometimes see it in stories, for example, that we'll receive. And we'll often say about these stories, well, yeah, I mean, I agree with what the writer's trying to do, but it doesn't work. And normally why it doesn't work, by the way, is that in stories like that, what you get is that they're making a true point through their story, but they're not telling it in a truthful way, right? You know, truth has to go all around for you to come up with a good, beautiful story. And so you can't just be trying to make a true point. You have to tell the point truthfully, right? You have to make the story itself truthful. The characters have to be true to life. The, you know, the situation, how it develops, the causality, everything has to be true to life. And when you have that unity of things, then you get something really beautiful and something much more powerful than if your story somehow magically ends with the bad, you know, immoral character becoming a new Catholic or something like that.
Yeah. Do you think it's piety that does that? Do you think there's a certain sense of I want to write a great story, but that's a pious story, and so, like you said, I've got to get this guy to convert by the end of this.
Right. Well, I don't think it's piety alone, because if impiety properly understood, right? I mean, there's a pejorative sense in which you can use piety, but you know. But piety, as in like properly honoring the things of God and so on, is a virtue. And you know, who had that more than a writer like Flannery O'Connor?
Right.
And yet, at the same time, she was witty and she was caustic and she told very gritty, true stories. So it's not the piety alone that does it. I think it's again an inability to appreciate real beauty that does it. And that's why, if we want to take it back to the architectural realm, right, so many Catholics have gotten tired of what I call like the Pizza Hut churches, right? You know, your church building looks like a Pizza Hut. And you know, we're kind of tired of that. And so we're longing for more traditional churches that actually look like churches. But often what has resulted from that, and I, every time I see it happen, you know, a little part of me dies, is when you get a church that is simply churchy, but it's not beautiful, really. And so you get there and you're like, yeah, well, this kind of looks like what churches are supposed to look at like, but then it's actually just, you know, a pastiche of what a really well-done traditional church looks like, right? But because we become unable to recognize the real thing from the kitschy version of the real thing, then we end up once again kind of failing, and so those are the kind of churches then that the people who let's say criticize traditional architecture say, oh well, but look at that, it, you know, it's so terrible. Who likes it? And other people who, you know, who might look at it might agree and say, well, yeah, that's not a very nice building, really. I mean, it's got some arches and so on, but it's out of proportion and right. and it's overdone and whatever. Yet at the same time, you have other people who are working, who are revitalizing that tradition. There are some wonderful architects right now who are building some gorgeous churches all over the country. And when you see those and you compare them to the fake version of them, it's very clear the difference.
Right.
And
there's always some element of newness. There's always it can't be truly beautiful and just be imitation. That's not possible.
Right. Right, and that's what our focus is. We say, hey, if you strive, you know, if you strive for beauty, if you strive for quality, you're almost inevitably going to end up being original in some way, right? Because these traditions are not static. I mean, the way I like to put it is, innovation happens within the context of tradition. True innovation presupposes tradition. Like, you don't get, I mean, if you think about it in terms of science, it makes perfect sense, right? I mean, you don't come up with technologies out of nothing. You build on previous scientific advances, and that's how you get to the new ones, and then you get a slightly better phone or a slightly better car, and so on and so forth. Changing the context in the artistic world, I think part of what is a pity of our current situation in the arts is that many of the arts have devolved into, well, I have to show my originality, because that is the only way that I can, you know, make a splash. And so every work tries to, quote unquote, be original and, you know, come straight from the mind of the artist and without being informed by previous traditions. But of course they end up being informed by previous traditions. It's just become a new tradition to reject the old traditions. Yet they are very empty traditions, because they haven't had this organic development over a long period of time. While if you take, you know, if you look at the history of art that is consciously building on tradition, but then trying to kind of push that forward in some way, you find something that's much more enduring. And you find, you know, you often find some work that is incredibly innovative, but it's innovative not because the artist is necessarily pushing his, you know, putting all his personality and his uniqueness all up in your face, but because it's, you know, it's work that is slowly growing organically and developing, and, you know, we change the way we do this a little different, and then we come to learn the type of, you know, the type of story that this is, or the type of novel this is, or the type of, you know, architectural design that this is, and we come to know the design so well that we can then know how to tweak it, how to change it, how to, you know, create a new effect that somebody hadn't tried before. And so that's a lot of what we want to do with the magazine.
Bernardo Aparicio Garcia is our guest, and Dappled Things, you can learn about it. It's dappledthings.org. That's, you just go there, right? And you can find out all about it.
That's right. Yeah. We have a pretty active blog, and we have a lot of our content online. To get the full content, you'd have to subscribe to either the print or digital edition, where you can, yep. you know, that way you can get all the stories, all the essays, and so on.
And now I'm curious about you personally. You go to UPenn to study economics and international relations. And is there a particular author, a particular artist, a movement, or something that got you to move in this direction, where now you are so deeply in the literary and artistic world?
Right, that's a long story. But if I'm gonna, let's see, if I'm gonna blame two people for it, one of them would be J.R.R. Tolkien, and another one would be my history professor, Walter McDougall. And J.R.R. Tolkien was the one that awoke me to beauty. The Lord of the Rings was the first book that really made me long for beauty, and that, and also in doing so, it made goodness so attractive. Uh-huh. So that's a book that I just can, you know, never forget. And which is a true for many other people as well. I like to say that, you know, that if you like The Lord of the Rings, then, you know, you might be a hardened criminal on death row, but I won't completely despair from you. And if you don't like The Lord of the Rings, I might, you know, still be suspicious, even if you're, you know, Mother Teresa. And the reason I say that is simply because there's so much beauty within that book.
Yeah.
That I sometimes think, you know, if you can react to what's in there, I think, you know, you're somehow on the right path. That was at least the case for me. The Lord of the Rings really awoke me to wanting beauty, to being just moved by it. And I didn't even realize at the time that J.R.R. Tolkien was a Catholic writer. I had no idea. But it set me on a path, definitely. It did what he wanted his books to do, which was to baptize the imagination with the sense of longing.
What a beautiful phrase.
Yeah, no, that's how they put it. Tolkien and Lewis, that's how they said they were trying to do with a lot of their works. So it definitely filled me with that sense of longing. And so as I got to college, there were different things that kind of started changing the path I was on. Because my path originally, I intended to go to college, you know, learn about economics and politics, and go back to Colombia and work in politics. That was my goal, and it was very clear to me that that's what I was doing. But, you know, this process that started with Tolkien then developed into learning more about my faith, which was a big thing in college, with, you know, many writers that you would know and that you featured in Catholic Answers. And they were definitely an influence. But then I think the clincher was during the last lecture that I had during my introduction to modern European history or something like that. And my professor was a very, very wise man, Walter McDougall. And he gave us in his final lecture a kind of a summary of what meaning he drew out of all this history that we had been learning. And among others, he quoted Alexander Solzhenitsyn's address to a Harvard commencement address that he gave, and where he talked about a world divided. And he, of course, was a survivor of the Gulag and Nobel Prize winning writer. And he was basically made the argument that the divide in the world was not between East and West, between communists and capitalists, but it was a divide that lay right through the center of the human heart. And in the context of that lecture, that really spoke to me, and it made me realize that that this work that I wanted to do in politics and so on, well, by the way, I won't say that it's not worthwhile. It is. But it made me realize that if I succeeded in everything that I wanted to succeed in that world, and that I, you know, let's say I did everything I wanted, I would still only have fixed a system. And that ultimately you could have the perfect system, and that if people, you know, inside their own heart were not where they should be, and their hearts were empty and so on, they were still not going to be any better off. Coming from Colombia, I used to see the U.S. as, you know, this place where, oh, they have everything they want. And I used to wonder, why, you know, why do they fight with each other? Why do people complain if Democrats, Republicans, who cares? Like, if we had the stuff they had here, we would never complain about anything. And after that class, I suddenly realized, of course we would. Of course we would. Because as long as things weren't right within, what's outside only can maybe enhance that or detract a little from that, but I felt that the real that the real work had to be done, you know, person by person, and that's when I got interested in the idea of writing and of teaching, which is what I do, you know, for a living day to day.
Well, we are all blessed by that conversion of heart that your professor brought about in you, if I could call it that. Maybe it's an intellectual conversion, but because Dappled Things is such a beautiful thing. And as I said, go to dappledthings.org to learn more about it. Bernardo Aparicio Garcia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, well, I don't think so. I think most of the pleasure was mine, Bernardo. Thank you so much. Thanks to all our listeners for joining us here on Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host. It's been a real pleasure. We'll hope to see you again next week.